Welcome back after the break. So in the last few weeks, we're kind of in the middle of a series of seminars. We've been looking at the six distinctive emphases of the Triratna Buddhist community in order. The Triratna Buddhist order and movement were started up in the 1960s. As a response to the modern world. The movement shares a lot of qualities with other movements, more older movements throughout the world. But it's got particular distinctive emphases. Bhante Sangharakshita, who started up the movement, saw that there were certain emphases that were it was useful to bring to the fore. Bring to the fore. This week we're going to look at the arts. Going back 2,500 years ago, the Buddha attained enlightenment, living in northern India. And he spent the rest of his life communicating what he'd found, this vision that he'd found. He saw the way things really were, and he was transformed by that experience. And he spent the rest of his life, he lived up till the age of 80, so from the age of 35 up to 80, he went around, and whoever would listen, he was communicating with whoever would listen. And he found lots of different ways of communicating the Dharma, communicating the truth. You might talk about Buddhism as a path of growth and development. It's leading all the way to enlightenment. And as Jnanavarsha was saying, we're going from less to more and from more to most. And the Buddha is the symbol, or, you know, he achieved the most, if you like. More kind, more aware, more fearless, generous, energetic, determined. So this path is transforming all aspects of our being, all of ourselves. We take all of ourselves on the path. So the Buddha communicated in many different ways. Quite often, you know, if you read the Buddhist sutras, these will be short stories or long parables, short anecdotes. Maybe they get quite philosophical, logical argument. And often he'd talk in poetic verse as well. So sometimes we get the idea that the Buddha, you know, what the Buddha said was a little bit dry. And maybe that's, we've been influenced by some of the early the early scholars of Buddhism, it's come down to as a series of lists. But actually, the Buddha often spoke in verse, and when he was at his most inspired, it's come down to as in verse. So it's not only, he wasn't only just speaking the truth, it had an aesthetic quality to it as well. And by his very presence, he communicated the Dharma as well. So he wasn't just communicating concepts, but by his very presence. And also his actions. And there's a story which is strongly influential in Zen Buddhism, where the Buddha holds up a small golden flower silently. He doesn't say anything. And one of his disciples, Mahakashyapa, sees the significance of that and smiles. And without a word being spoken, the Buddha can see that Kashyapa, Mahakashyapa, has understood. And so the transmission of the Dharma happened through just a symbol, through just holding up a flower. So this is the start of the Zen tradition. So not only concepts, but myth. Symbols, painting, sculpture, drama, ritual, music. The Dharma is communicated in all these different ways. And, you know, if we look back at the history of Buddhism in various countries in the East, we see some very rich and sublime artistic traditions developing, some really beautiful works of art. And not least, actually, in the figure of the Buddha. So a few weeks when we started this seminar, I think Subhadramati was asking, you know, what would you like to talk about? And somebody was saying, well, what's the meaning of, you know, why do we have the figure of the Buddha? Because the figure of the Buddha is everywhere, isn't it? You know, it's very, very popular. If you travel in the East, it's all over. Well, in the early days, soon after, at the time of the Buddha, there weren't any sculptures of the Buddha, rupas. And after his death, after his parinirvana, it was as if people didn't sort of naturally want to make sculptures of the Buddha. It was as if it couldn't do justice to the Buddha. People still had that presence, that sense of who the Buddha was. And what, you know, whatever you produced in a sculpture couldn't come near it. So quite often symbolism was used. So footprints would be painted or sculpted, or a parasol would be used as a symbol of nobility, of kingship. And these are used as a way of inferring what the Buddha was. So from the earliest days, this symbolism was used. But it wasn't for a while, it wasn't until centuries later when the first statues of the Buddha were sculpted. And if you look through the East, through the different countries, you see lots of different types of Buddha figures in different holding their hands, a hand mudra, so a mudra is a hand position. So for instance, the figure we've got here is holding his hands in meditation mudra. The one next door in the small shrine room is holding his hands up in fearless mudra. And there's also the earth touching mudra, which is in the Buddha's own life story, where he touches the earth when Mara doubts him. So there's many different forms of the Buddha. You get the ones where the Buddha is lying down, and this is near the end of his life, the parinirvana. And these Buddha statues, these Buddha rupas, are objects of devotion for a lot of Buddhists around the world. They can, when you reflect, when you actually look at the images of the Buddha, whether painting or in sculpture, something of the quality, particularly if it's a really well-made sculpture or painting, something of the Buddha's qualities can come through. And quite often, so people who don't know anything about Buddhism will, when they see a Buddha, you know, they might purchase the Buddha, or there's something that draws them to the Buddha. I think because particularly if the artist is skilled, it will communicate something of the qualities, the values of the Buddha. I'm just wondering if that's something that's in your experience. Did you come across an image of the Buddha maybe before you were a Buddhist? Maybe you were travelling? Maybe you saw one in a shop?
I saw an image in a temple in Thailand. That's a very huge. I wonder why they're so huge.
Oh, wow. What can you say a bit more about
this? It was
the
a lying down one.
Ah, yeah.
So now you've just explained.
Yes. Yes.
But I was wondering why they're so massive.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm not quite sure in a way, but I guess, I've seen the pictures of the Buddha, I think, in Kamakura in Japan, and it's just massive, and it just sort of has a certain presence just through the vastness of its size, you know. And maybe because the Buddha image is a symbol, so it's a symbol for enlightenment. So it's not trying to be literal about it. So the Buddha figure here isn't literally how the Buddha looked. Well, we're not quite sure how the Buddha looked really, you know, but I imagine he wasn't gold, you know. So there's this, you know, so what is gold? What's gold pointing at? So the thing with a symbol is it's trying to get at something which, you know, outside concepts, as it were. It doesn't have to be mediated by concepts. You don't have to think, oh, gold, it means such and such. You can if you want, but just allowing the figure, this figure, to have an effect on you. So what does this gold, you know, how does it affect you? The colour of gold. Or like, say, the size of the Buddha. I remember going to India, where the Buddha attained Parinirvana, where he died. And again, they've got this massive lying down Buddha. And it's quite moving, and it's quite, you know, it's obviously been an object of devotion for many, many years. And it's just, you know, there's monks looking after it and people offering flowers, and all the time, all through the day, there's this devotion going on. It's like we need something to devote, you know, there's something in us that really needs to devote ourselves to. And in a way, the image or the, you know, the sculpture, the rupa, can fulfill that. Give us something to, you know, a devotion. Anybody else? A Buddha image making an impression?
I remember being in China 10 years ago and being at a Buddhist temple, and I bought some incense because I didn't really know what the point of the, what the meaning behind the incense was, but I felt that, you know, by someone in the way in, put it around the temple, because there were various different shrines.
Yes, yes.
And there was one shrine, and I lit some incense and put it in a sand pit, you know, and a woman came screaming at me in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And it turned out you weren't allowed fire in there because it was a very old shrine.
Right.
So everyone just put the incense there. And I remember this overwhelming sadness that committed this atrocity.
Right. Yes.
And even though we couldn't communicate language-wise, I knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
Left with my head hung.
Oh dear. And do you remember the image? What was the? Do you remember? Was it a sculpture?
I remember it was this lady was saying massive in gold.
Yeah.
And I think it's that lotus position.
Yeah.
But you saying of artwork inspired by Buddhism, there were huge, do you know, the balls of wood? And they carve out inside using tiny tools, so they carve another ball.
Oh, wow.
Inside ball.
Oh, yeah.
With all these patterns, and they keep doing this. Or maybe 10 balls, you know, the main one was this big, and then another one inside that. And each one is completely, although it was one solid block of wood, completely separated.
Oh, wow.
And these silk paintings as well, a lot of incredible artwork.
Yes.
By the dedication.
Yes.
And
yes.
The patience that people had developed through their practice.
And that sounds wonderful. And China is when Buddhism has spread throughout the East, it often took sort of higher culture with it. It took art, you know, the sciences of the time, all sorts of culture. But China was the one place where it met a civilization which had a very developed culture. So, and it did influence it, and it helped to sort of reignite some of the artistic traditions in China. So the Dharma has been communicated through concepts, through symbols, to the primary ways that the Dharma has communicated, not only from the Buddha, but all the way down through the centuries. This was the way the Dharma has been communicated. And Buddhist cultures developed, and get a snapshot, you get an idea of the Chinese culture that developed, but also the Tibetan culture, and maybe because of the way that Tibet was far away from a lot of other cultures, it developed a unique culture, and in somewhere where everything became the Dharma, became a whole Buddhist culture. So painting, sculpture, music, drama, architecture, dance, they were all forms of the Dharma, all expressing the Dharma. And I could just, you know, one can just imagine what would that be like, where you're living in a you know, in a whole world where everything is expressive of what the Buddha was trying to communicate. It's quite something. And I think we get a bit of a glimpse of that when we go on retreat, because, you know, you go to a retreat centre which is made for retreats, and there's the Buddha figure there, and the gardens will have been looked after, and it's very beautiful, flowers are growing, the architecture is hopefully beautiful. And you just get a little glimpse of that, you know, going for a weekend or a week on retreat. And I just imagine, well, how would that be to live all your life, you know, within, you know, being, you know, within the Dharma. So, appreciation and practice of the arts can enable us to grow and develop. So, in a way, we can think of the arts as a parallel way of growth and development, something that we can engage with. And so what I thought we'd do is just explore different aspects of this. So first off, art can help us expand our experience and broaden our sympathies. So what do we mean by that? Well, it sort of allows us to live through experiences that never happened to us. So I've been particularly struck by this. I've just been reading around this last week or two. And at this point I thought I was particularly, you know, so you might read a novel or see a play and something really strikes you, you know, you really enter into that world. Maybe you've read some Dickens, or maybe you've seen some Shakespeare, or whatever you've engaged with. And to some extent you enter into the lives of the people involved. You feel what it likes to, you know, what it's like to feel that person. You think, you know, how they think. You know, you experience the conditions. Maybe if it's Oliver Twist, you know, you have a sense of what it would be like in the mid-19th century being in abject poverty and, you know, as a child. And it really allows you this imaginative identification. It really allows you to take that leap. I mean, so much of... inevitably, we look at things from our own perspective. You know, I look at things from, you know, an Englishman's perspective, you know, of our time. And it's very difficult to sort of get out of that. But if we open ourselves up to art from that expresses, you know, a different time, a different period, people with different temperaments, we can really have a sense of other people. And this is a real growth. This is actually part of growth and development. And it's a real spirit, it can be a real spiritual experience. It might not be the you know, you might not be blissed out, but this imaginative identification is a real part. And you can think of it in terms of when we do the metta bhavana. When we do the metta bhavana, we're really using our imagination to identify with others. We're identifying with our friend, with the neutral person, someone we hardly know, and with someone we find difficult. And the more we can be aware of each of these people in each category, with this open-hearted sympathy, this kindness, and the more we can sort of enter into their lives, and we actually grow from that. So I was wondering if there's anything occur to you? Maybe that exercise we did before the break. Has anyone got an experience of that? You know, having read a book, a novel, seen a play or a film. Maybe even, you know, looked at a painting. You know, there's the paintings of Rembrandt, of, you know, self-portraitures, where you just see, you know, his own self reflected back.
This wasn't the experience that
great.
This isn't the experience I mentioned when we were discussing these before the break. So I remember the first time, because I'm a musician, so I've always been moved by music. But the first time I was moved by art, which I've been to see my whole life, going to galleries with my parents, etc., was a piece of one of Leonardo's contemporaries. I don't know what the piece was called or who the artist was, but it was caught unaware. You know, an army have been caught in the night, you know, when they're all in bed, camped down, they're expecting the battle to start the next morning, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's everyone grabbing for swords and arrows flying in,
yes,
all sorts of things. And in the middle of the painting, there's one guy with just abject fear in his eyes, completely, totally, perfectly captured. And I looked at that and I welled up. And I stood there for 5 minutes going, wow, okay, is this normal? Is this okay? And after, maybe it was a minute, maybe it was 13 seconds, you know, I looked to my left and there was an old lady of, you know, 70s or 80s. And the look on her face was exactly how I felt.
So
I went, okay, no, this is cool, this is...
Yes,
yes, thing, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, I think that's really, you know, I think that's really beautiful, you know, just the way you've explained it, you know, this sort of your own response to seeing that painting, and in a way your imaginative identification of what it must have been like to be in that situation, you know, and it's a real situation for people, isn't it, to feel that abject fear.
I mean, this guy was almost asking for help, which is quite impressive, because it was charcoal on, so you know, not, let's say painting, not even the detail of colour.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So the skill of the artist really managed to bring that alive. Yeah. Cool.
In my first year of uni, I had a really rough time, and someone recommended Claire de Lune to me to listen to fall asleep. It's a bit stereotypical, but it's meant to be one of those nice, calming classical songs. And so that was like the soundtrack to a really crappy couple of months. Mm. And then my friend Laura, who plays the piano, just suddenly whipped out this piece of music. And she's like, I know you like this one, so I'm going to play it for you. Mm. And she sat down and she struggled with it because it's really challenging. It's not easy to play. And suddenly having this real human being who was my friend and who really, really loved me and wanted me to be better made that music so much more real. And it wasn't just something on the radio or my iPod or whatever. It was something that was made by another human being a long time ago to communicate feelings of peace and love and compassion. And that she was using that same very, very old voice to speak to me.
Yes.
And that was really, really moving and very sweet. And I appreciated that a lot.
Yeah. That's lovely, isn't it? And you saw the all those connections, didn't you? You know, what your friend was trying to do, but also that connection back through history of what the, you know, the composer was, you know, maybe you had an idea of what the composer was trying to get at as well. Yeah. Something lovely about sort of someone performing, isn't there? I think something live. You know.
I saw a film, if I may share that with you.
Oh, yes.
It's called The Fifth Seal. Ah. It plays in during the time of the Second World War, coming near to the end there. Fascism was dominant in Central and Eastern Europe.
Yes.
And it plays in a pub late in the evening where there are four middle-aged gentlemen playing cards and having a discussion, like having fun, as much as someone can have at these times. And one of them is very philosophical, and at one point in the evening he asks a friend a certain question. But before that, another guy comes knocking on the door and comes in. He's disabled. And notices that they are talking about the system. And back then, in the dictatorial time, it was forbidden to judge the system or even talk anything about it. And the question of that guy is, if you were given a choice, who would you be? The idea is that you're on an island. You are on an island. And you can either be the ruler, called Tamotsel Skatatiki. It's a sort of a Middle American name, doesn't matter. Who's a very, very incredibly harsh dictator and ruler, and he describes he's very cruel. Or you could be one of his slaves, Gordy Judy. And at the end of the day, the question is, what would you choose? Would you be someone who is who's got everything what he can, but the only single thing what he doesn't have is a clear consciousness? Or would you be that slave, completely repressed, but with a clear consciousness, and someone who can actually look into the mirror? And later on, the second half of the film, they both get caught, brought into some kind of prison, because the guy who came in turned out to be someone who turned them in for the system that he heard they were talking about forbidden things. And after a series of torture, they are given a choice. They can freely leave the place if they slap another person who was tortured and kind of hung up close to his death. If they gave him a slap, they can freely leave. And of the four guys, three of them can't do it, and they get shot straight in the scene. The fourth one does, and they're not allowed to leave, but he only does it because he's hiding Jewish people back in his apartment. Obviously, in the Second World War, it was kind of a crime. And this film, for me, really made me think about what is the choice we have to make, and what is the real deal, in a sense.
Yeah. You can see it's sort of really thought-provoking, isn't it, and really getting to the nub of, you know, getting to the core of something there, you know, how we live our lives, and that, you know, like you say, the choices we might have to make. Or I was really struck by what you were saying about, you know, sort of what would you choose, as it were, you know, would you have a clear conscience, or would you like power? So lots of, you know, engaging with the arts, we can really get a sense, we can get to, where we can let the artists have their effect on us. You know, the artist has created something from a vision, if you like, and by us engaging with their, you know, with their work of art, we can have a glimpse of that vision. I remember reading Homer's Odyssey, and absolutely loving it. I've heard it described as the first novel, because I think I was a bit tentative, actually. I thought, oh dear, this is going to be really difficult, and actually it read, you know, really, really easily. And one of the things I was really struck by was just quite a different worldview than I'd come across before. You know, this idea of making offerings. And at every point, there was this implicit belief in the god realm, you know, the gods, the Greek gods. And, you know, the hero would be making offerings to the gods. Not sort of questioning it, but this is just something you did. You know, you made your burnt offerings to the gods. And I remember it really made quite an impression of me. You know, because in the world we live in now, that sort of idea is sort of quite, seems a bit quaint or something. And but, you know, just the way it came across was coming across quite forcefully of, you know, just quite a different way of being. Allowing there's something more than just our everyday sort of mundane material sense, you know, materialistic. So yeah, art allows us to know what it's like to be another human being from a completely different background to us. And it's sort of in, yes, it involves this sort of expansion of our being. And this broadening sympathies with others. I was saying before, it's got this link with, the metta bhavana, which we practice. I often think about, the neutral person, when we try and imagine what they're like. We can often have this sense of open curiosity towards this person. Because we, in a way, we don't know. They're a fellow human being like us. But we don't know who they are or what they're like. We don't know much about them. And we can begin to open our sympathies towards them. And maybe the arts can help with that, because we begin to develop our imagination. And the more we develop our imagination, the more we can enter into the spiritual life. The imagination is such an important facet. A synthesis of reason and emotion, and with an awareness of something higher. Hello.
Isn't there something or some viewpoint about some art that's not looking, not necessarily the humanistic side of it, but that the actual proportions of the way the artists have used things in the same as in iconography, that it actually has a profound effect on that higher self or that that beingness, and that. In some forms of art that are not necessarily using imagery. I know you are talking about connecting with humanity in that sense and emotion and stuff. But the other part of us, that deeper part that you're talking about, glimpses of that you might that more sort of offering towards and stuff, is actually attainable or can resonate with that side of us. I remember looking up even in one of the Tatel somewhere, some of the old masters. There was one of, I think it's Christ with a dove above his head or whatever. They actually look at the proportions within that are the divine proportions that the artists actually use. So some artists manage to actually use those proportions instinctively. They're resonating from that part of, I'm guessing, maybe they use a particular format.
Something, well, I suppose like symbolism doesn't have to be go through it, something it will speak to you, as it were, I suppose, again, looking at the figure of a Buddha, might have been made in Tibet or Thailand, so, but you can speak to someone who knows nothing about Buddhism, as it were. So maybe there's something similar there. Actually knowing something about the art probably helps in a way. You can really appreciate it from, like you say, if you're an artist yourself, if you're a musician or you write yourself, you can have a deeper sort of sympathy and understanding with a piece of art. But like you say, things can really communicate even if you don't as well.
Even if you don't really, because I think that with non-figurative art has become more and more popular with people. And if you think about the aesthetics that you're talking about what anybody involved in a retreat or here would try to create, I think a lot of it doesn't actually have that kind of representational aspect at all. I think it's quite important. I think you talk about the higher experience as sublime. I don't know whether you're going to go on to talk about that, because I think that's really important, direct experience that people have.
Of the...
It could be visual, but it more and more I think people are getting into objects as well. Like going to take one and look at things and know what they are. But you know, I think that's really important in terms of it's more common in music's much more visceral, isn't it? But I just wondered if you're going to go on to that, because you talk about empathising characters like in literature or even looking at portraits or whatever. I think there's something that's really much more not about anything solid,
right?
Not about something that you comprehend in a literal way.
Yes. Maybe it's just but maybe it's a feeling, as it were.
It's an emotional response, and it can happen to shape and form and music in anything. So I think that's really important.
Yes. I think it's really important to notice those responses when we come across, and really be open to those responses and see what effect it has on us in a way. And it is part, I suppose, being mindful to what's actually going on, and being more and more sensitive to our surroundings, that nature, beauty, and works of art. Quite often, we live in the city, and I mean, there are parts of London, I think, are quite beautiful, but there's quite sort of, you know, grim bits as well. So, you know, we're surrounded by noise, pollution. And so I think, you know, art can really help us get in touch with that awe and wonder, sense of beauty, and can help to sort of, get in touch with the beauty. So I think this next point is sort of in that general area, to do with art can have a refining and sense on our emotions. It helps to refine and redirect our emotions. So if we're honest about our emotions, quite often they're linked to what you might call our animal ego. This sort of sense of wanting to possess. It's all about pleasure, maybe money, possessions, sex, status, security. A lot of it is, you know, is about that, if we're actually honest with ourselves about it. But if we keep being stuck at this level, at this sort of animal level, if you like, then we won't probably have much drive for the spiritual life. So what art can help us do, and beauty, it might be an experience of nature, but it helps us to progressively refine and raise the level of our emotions. And so we're actually getting a more refined sense of pleasure, and also we get more satisfaction from the spiritual life. So we can delight in beauty, delight in music, delight in painting, in the books we read, etc.
I just think what you said about being in urban settings and having to go into natural ones to find beauty.
Yeah.
And I saw this really awesome play called Limbo.
Right.
And a person stands on stage and he makes these amazing imitations of trains and planes and things like that, and he holds up a siren and all of a sudden the beat drops, and he's using a police siren and all these city urban sounds to make a really, really catchy song, and it's absolutely brilliant, and it's hilarious, and it's really smart. And he had these artists who do things like cleaning really dirty walls into murals,
right?
And the council can't really arrest them for cleaning, because that's fine. But they make some incredible works of art like that. So I think that some of the best artists, poets, singers don't try to shut themselves off from the world they're living in, or go to the lake district and afford that. They see the beauty around them in dirty things and broken things and strange things and smelly things. I mean, that's really powerful as well.
It's interesting. I've got a friend who's an artist, and I think we're on different sides of the pole there, because I'm more of the, actually, I do need nature, and I do need sort of the beauty of nature. And when we're walking around, he'll point out the beauty that he sees in the buildings around, you know. And it's very interesting having that, you know. He can quite often, I think, see what you're seeing, is that the beauty in everyday objects.
I think this is really important, because I've only done one, but I did the Wobby wabi-sabi.
Wabi-sabi.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It made me appreciate what modern artists are doing more too, because it's things like, I know I'm now obsessed with walls and paintings and stones and things like that, you know, because that to me is part of mindfulness practice. It's like what you can actually see. It's the joy of actually just being able to see, or it could be sound, it could be anything. To me, it's not either or at all.
That's interesting. No, it's very interesting. Yeah.
I just want to share an experience I had like this weekend. I'm not an artist or anything, but I just got a piece of paper, big piece of paper, in front of me with some crayons and paints and stuff like that. And I was impressed with just try and put something on paper, you don't even know what you're gonna do. And it's kind of something is already inside you, and if the art itself can help you to understand something, you can't just think. It's kind of like meditation, you kind of get to know something that is inside you, but it's not easy to actually put on words. And you just go without any intention, it's so that suddenly something appears and it like changes form and things. Yeah, so it's quite interesting thing, and I think there's a bit of an artist in everybody, so I mean there are many ways to actually get to know more about yourself.
It's quite an interesting process, that, isn't it? Or you can do it with writing, creative writing as well.
I think if it's music, then you kind of have to know how to play an instrument and everything, but just drawing or putting whatever in the paper, that is kind of anybody can do.
Yeah, similarly, anyone can make sounds. Music is not, you know, the fine thing, piano or guitar, whatever. It's we made any which way.
Depending on the instrument, there's some instrument that is saxophone or something.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
It's kind of taking up what you were saying. You were saying up there, it's like you can see beauty in anything. It could be urban or it can be nature, but it's. For me, it's kind of like whatever you sit down and try to draw, you know, it might just be a cup or a fork, a knife. It's the act of sitting down and really concentrating and focusing and really looking at just what's there and noticing what you yourself are interested in and then translating it and, you know, putting it onto paper. And I, it was something that struck me when I first started to meditate when someone said to me, right, well, you know, just concentrate on the breath, take an interest in it, just look at it, and see what your breath is actually looking like.
Yes.
And the kind of connection with just sitting down and drawing
was
very similar to the process of sitting down and taking an interest in the breath.
Yes.
Whatever is there is interesting.
Yes, yes.
And as you do that, like you say, something that's in there inside of you just comes out on the
And with that spirit of curiosity, what I got from what you were saying, this kind of an openness.
You know what's there in front of you, just look at it really carefully. And what you're interested in is what you're looking at. So somebody else drawing the same object will produce something different, even though it's the same thing there in front of you. It's a kind of form of expression and interest.
I think there's an interesting sort of poles, if you like, of appropriation at one pole and appreciation at the other pole, if you like. And so we can have a tendency in our lives of appropriation. You know, we want to get things, we want to get people, we want to grasp after things. This is sort of the self-oriented way of being. And then maybe what we're pointing more towards in art is an appreciative awareness. And I think it's what you've been talking about, this sort of curiosity and openness and appreciation. And you're not actually getting it for yourself, as it were. You're not sort of, but you're just being open to something else. There's a story from Bhante Sangharakshita where, when he was in India years ago, he was walking, down the road, and he saw this wonderful tree, and he was walking with a companion, and he just said to his companion, "Oh, look at that magnificent tree." And it was really beautiful. And his companion said, "Oh yes, how much firewood it would make." And, you know, really bringing those two different modes of being, if you like. You know, one where you just see a tree as firewood, and the other one where you actually just open up to the beauty, the magnificence of a living tree.
I've really been enjoying everything everyone said. Thank you. This one thing that, again, right back to the story of the person who made the music out of all of the different sounds of the city. I saw a prom a couple of years ago, and I was told, I forget who the composer was, that his father, as a young child, when he was a young child, made him listen and stand in the crossroads. He lived near Tin Pan Alley, where all of the tunesmiths were writing all of the music, and appreciate the cacophony of all of the different sounds. And that was what kind of, I mean, his music wasn't easy to listen to. I wouldn't say but it's easy. But it is interesting that what you choose to appreciate.
That's right. It's almost, I mean, it's like being, say, round Bethnal Green, and if we, you know, if we hear all the noises, so I live upstairs, and then, and if I just get frustrated with those noises and I just want to push it away, it makes it such a painful experience. It's almost being open to the noise as it is, you know, you can just welcome it in. You just go, oh yeah, someone's got their, you know, their car radio at max, and you know, somebody's, you know, pipping a horn, and you can just, it is like a symphony, you know, Bethnal Green Symphony.
Yeah, it's really inspired me to try something very, probably very naive and childlike, but this application of the metta bhavana. When I get home, I want to find a favourite picture, like a real friend, and a picture that perhaps I haven't been able to look at, it's at the bottom of the pile, and then one that sort of I tend to pass by, it's sort of fairly average, and so on and so forth. And you know, apply literally, as I say, in a very naive, childlike way, because I haven't heard this concept before. I probably haven't heard you talk enough at LBC, because that was a new one to me tonight. So thank you for that.
Well, that sounds a really interesting idea. Yeah, you can imagine doing all sorts of things, couldn't you? Food and, you know, sort of.
I mean, the way music. I do to my, you know, friend. In the metta bhavana practice, etc. Correct. Like to the image.
Yes.
See what they've got in common.
Great, thank you. So, in the last few minutes, just want to move on to the sort of a third point. So, as I was saying before, the Buddhist spiritual life is a progression from, well, greed, hatred, self-preoccupation to one of generosity, love, awareness, self-transcendence. So, you might like to see that as a hierarchy of values. Generosity is better than greed. So the Buddhist view would definitely say that. Because what, you know, greed and self-preoccupation do is maintain this fixed and separate sense of self. But generosity, other regarding, self-transcendence is more in the nature of how things are, of the interconnectedness. So there's an ethical dimension, you know, there's an ethical hierarchy of values, but also there's an aesthetic side of this as well, an aesthetic dimension, and it is to do with this appropriation and appreciation. Appreciation is better than appropriation, if you like to see that. It's higher up on the hierarchy. And, you know, to experience something as beautiful, we're lifted out of our sense of self-concern. And as a hierarchy of beauty, and I think this is something that great art can really help us move beyond ourselves, beyond our self-preoccupation. We can learn to be open and receptive to it, and get a bigger perspective from engaging with this great piece of art. So in this last couple of minutes, I'm just wondering about that, whether that, how that strikes you, and it, you know, the difference between, say, art that helps us develop spiritually and art that might be just entertainment. So I'm wondering how that strikes you.
I need to say something about the hierarchy.
Yeah, interesting.
Because the aesthetic of, like, you know, if somebody was to frame and draw a fragment from what's in front of my nose now, they could make it beautiful. I think it's really quite important, because I think that the it doesn't actually cut out the importance of traditionally extremely good art say that we can all make it. Do you see what I mean? We can do it as well. Somebody can expose something to us in a way that is very enlightening. I wonder, it's come up quite a lot about hierarchy, I think, with the way that the arts are discussed within the movement. I think it's quite important. It's not practice, it's discussion, do you see what I mean? About hierarchy, so I'm questioning that.
I guess one can appreciate great art and say, you know, have a go at painting yourself, have a go at writing. It doesn't make that, because you think something is really good, doesn't make what you do, you know, you don't have to be harsh about it.
I just wanted to emphasise that. It's not the same as what you were saying about stuff that isn't good for our spiritual progression, like horror movies or something. Because I think that's a really good example. That there's a lot of negative stuff being pumped out, I think, that we need to guard against, actually.
I guess we, if you just notice the effect things have on you, you know, so I think that's, we always have to bring ourselves back to our experience, I think, in a way.
Well, the idea of beauty is quite interesting, I think. Because quite often it's something that you're on the outside of, and it's a judgment. And then there's something about art that actually is you making a connection with, and it's you're connecting with a flow that's going on. I saw it was a Leonardo picture of the Annunciation, and the angel coming into land, it seemed to capture a moment when the angel was still in motion, but his foot was on the ground at the same time. So it was the exact moment of landing, absolutely to the exact second. And so it was flowing, and yet it was stopping at the same time. And that's a different thing from saying this is beautiful.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, I think you're talking like an experience of beauty, aren't you? So, as it were, the beauty is in your experience in a certain way. You can say yourself is beauty as well, your beautiful experience. And in a way, you're transformed by that.
Yeah, that's it.
Experience.
Yeah, so you're transformed
by beauty.
Yeah.
And it's said that great art asks you to change your life, which is interesting. You know, it gets you to see things differently.
Yeah, it did.
Hey, Jessica.
As much as I love beautiful art and beautiful lakes and beautiful music, I don't think that art or Buddhism can be all about beauty. I mean, like, I kind of disagree with the horror movie thing, because my mother and my grandmother came from a tradition in the Caribbean where they would have people in the village who could keep stories. And these fairy stories were never anywhere near as like pretty as the Disney ones. They're all about demons and monsters and death and fear, and you gather together, it'd be really dark, and you think you could hear a creaking, and it was about sharing fears and facing fears and naming them in a really communal and supportive setting. So you come together and sort of let out all the bad thoughts or express them in a really safe and creative way. And I went on this writer's course where I was sort of made to write poems. I looked around and I was like, I can't see any mountains or angels or anything like that that I can write about. But really it wasn't about writing poems, it was about being a poem and seeing the beauty everywhere you could find it. And that means looking at sadness as well and grief and still making art out of it, not just in the things you create, but the way you behave, like seeing beauty in it, being creative and making something good out of it anyway. So yeah.
Good point.
That when you said that about avoiding, putting blinkers on and avoiding certain stuff, because I know a lot of people might think of it as art or even music, but I grew up listening to hip-hop music, and there's a lot of it which is violent, misogynist, but there's a lot of it that's really conscious and thoughtful and intelligent, and I think that by denying, saying, oh, it's harmful, and not looking at it, you're kind of, you know, that's a big it's worldwide now, but it was a subsection of people who have their own stories to tell, and it's really important that it was, you know, specifically came from the impoverished areas of Brooklyn, but why shouldn't those people tell their story?
I think it's important not to sort of, if one appreciates, as it were, great art, it doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that you've got to rubbish other things.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is really valuable, and, you know, both of what you're saying, you know, it's, you know, engaging. And just, and it is that noticing what effect it has on yourself. Mm-hmm. And you might find that, you know, or maybe hip-hop, or, you know, what we were talking about, these folk stories, you know, they really have an enlivening effect on us, maybe. I think that's the key, as it were, to see how art affects us. I'm aware of the time, and I think we could keep on talking for a lot longer. I'm ashamed to bring this to a close. So, we've gone over time. So thank you very much. It's been really interesting. And, hope to see you all next week. And we'll be exploring another emphasis. Okay.